Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. It's my great pleasure to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences, and to introduce our speaker tonight, Caroline Guicciardi, who is speaking about Leonardo da Vinci's dress, the pattern in the dress for the Mona Lisa. Leonardo da Vinci's dress, of course. The pattern she found in the dress and the interesting research that she found out. And when the idea was proposed to me, I said, anything about Leonardo. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. So we're going to have a whole lecture tonight on Da Vinci knots. So right here is, of course, Renaissance painter Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa, the most famous painting in the world, the most written about, the most sung about, and the most visited. 8.5 million visitors every year go to the Louvre Museum to see this one painting. It's said to be uninsurable. She's so valuable. How many people have gone to Paris and seen the painting? Wow, everybody. That's fantastic. Many people ask me when they've seen it, what's the big deal? I mean, why should I even like this painting? And it's always, oh, how small it is. Well, actually, the two posters I have are exact size. They're an exact replica. The original one was not on canvas. It was on poplar board, which was a really inferior type of wood. And even Leonardo said in his writings not to use inferior wood, only use hardwoods like oak and walnut. But, of course, he went against his own writings. So this particular piece here has been shot at a really high resolution of 240 million pixels. And it's as good as seeing the original. It comes from Pascal Cotte's collection. Now, the only problem is you can't get up close and personal to the Mona Lisa because she's always in her bulletproof box, and she only comes out one day a year. So it would probably be easier for you to get tea with the Queen than actually get to see this painting. Now, perhaps you heard just recently, a couple months ago, breaking news that they're opening a Florentine tomb hoping to identify the bones thought to be the model for Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa portrait. If it can be verified, they want to DNA it. They're going to do a virtual restoration on her face and plan to compare it with Leonardo's version. So you've got to ask yourself, you know, why? Like, why after 500 years do we need to know who this woman is? Why aren't we just satisfied knowing that this is just a mastery piece of artwork, composition, technique, execution? Well, the simple answer is no, it's not good enough, because on some level, see, we know that there's something more to this painting that Leonardo hasn't told us. We can't put our finger on it, but we just know in our hearts and minds, and after 500 years, we're still questioning it. But really what we want to know, more than wanting to know who this woman is in this portrait, is we want to know who she was to you, Leonardo. And did you love her? So my goal tonight is to give you some closure to this age-old mystery. Well, we have a problem. See, the Mona Lisa is shrouded in mystery. We have no historical documents. We have no contract. We have no eyewitnesses. We have no correspondence. And we have no preliminary drawings in any of his notebooks. So the only thing I can tell you for a fact is Leonardo never relinquished the painting. It remained in his possession for 16 years till his death in France. And here's a painting done in the 1900s by Mussini depicting that moment of him taking his last breath, the King of France by his side, and Mona Lisa nearby. Now, our source material as to the identity of the model comes from art historian Giorgio Vasari. And he wrote a book in 1550 called Lives of the Artists. And he tells us that the Florentine woman is Lisa del Giocondo, the wife of a silk merchant. But there's a problem. He never meets Leonardo. In fact, he does it 30 years after Leonardo's dead. He never saw the Mona Lisa. And it's very dubious that he ever met the Gioconda family in Florence. Well, I was resolved. I had no problem believing that the sitter in this portrait was this woman called Lisa Del Giocondo. But doubt set it in when I started filming a documentary in 2007 on a French photographer, Pascal Cotte, called Mona Lisa Reveal. Cotte invented this camera called the multispectral camera that got to shoot the real Mona Lisa at 240 million pixels and discovered secrets. And what I kind of tell everyone jokingly and half serious is that he got to photograph the most famous woman in the world. Now, his camera really isn't a camera like in our sense of a word. It photographs from infrared to ultraviolet. So it's a band of light. And what put Cotte on the map was that he made a discovery on the infrared that Leonardo originally painted her with eyebrows and eyelashes. And that news went around the globe and basically put us on the map. So here is the infrared. So if you and I were Superman and we could peel the pictorial layer off the painting, this is what we'd see. And we get really a lot of information from an artist when we see the underdrawing. We know exactly where they touched down, and we also know exactly what changes that are made. So one reason I brought this to this presentation today is because there's been this rumor that the painting was a self-portrait that Leonardo did of himself, and then on the pictorial layer, it was a woman. But through and through, on the underdrawing and on the pictorial layer, it is a woman. The only real change that Leonardo made was on her index finger. He moved the position. So doubt set in as to the identity of Lisa Del Giocondo, a.k.a. Mona Lisa, during the filming of the documentary interviewing Giuseppe Palantini in Florence. And he had conducted a very interesting research. He was a teacher by profession, but what he did on the side is he would go through the archive records in Florence, and he found out where Lisa Del Giocondo and all the places she lived in Florence. So that morning, filming the documentary, he takes us on a walking tour of Florence. And, you know, it sort of kind of blows your mind that these streets and the palazzos after 500 years are still there. And we're here at the street where Lisa and her husband, the wealthy silk merchant, Francesco Giocondo, lived on Via Bonfanti. Looks, you know, with the graffiti, I'm sure you've got to visualize what it looked like 500 years ago. But the other discovery that Palantini made was that his neighbor was none other than Leonardo's father, Ciapiero. And he was a lawyer. He handled some legal matters for the Gioconda family. So Giuseppe has conjured up how Leonardo and the Gioconda family got together for this portrait. So at this time, Leonardo has left Milan. The war has broken out in Milan. He moves back to his hometown of Florence. Prior reconnects with his dad, and his dad introduces him to the Gioconda family and gets him this portrait job. And that's how the painting comes into existence. But let's just analyze for a second. But I posed a question to Giuseppe Palantini. I said, there's only two ways this painting can happen. It either was commissioned or it was freelanced. Which do you choose? He thought a moment and he said, you know, I think it was freelanced. And I thought, oh, I don't know any artist in the 15th century that was in the business of freelancing any type of artwork. And a very interesting anomaly that I added to my basket of thoughts. So what is Leonardo doing at this time? He's back in Florence. He's lost his job with the Duke for 25 years. Well, you know, keep in mind, he is well known. He's done the Last Supper. Of course, when he's back in Florence, he's not, you know, top dog. There's another artist by the name of Michelangelo that's 25 years his younger, who has just finished the David. Now, he's not hard up for work. If he wants a job doing a portrait, or, you know, we have the Marchesa Isabella d'Este that's biting at the bit to get her portrait done. But it's just questionable, you know, what kind of work he wants to do. So we know that Leonardo starts the portrait in Florence in 1503, and we know he doesn't have a job, and we also know that he's living off of his savings. Just like today, we follow the money. So my next interview was in England, and I interviewed a Renaissance fashion expert by the name of Jane Bridgman, who cast some doubt as to Lisa Giocondo being the sitter for the painting. So we started off the interview, and she could not agree that the painting had started in 1503, which most of the Da Vinci experts all agree that it starts in 1503. And I asked her, well, why? And she says, well, look at the neckline. That neckline was not, it was out of style in 1503. Well, I don't know that much about, you know, fashion in the 1500s. And she says, besides, she's wearing a frumpy house dress. Would you sit for your portrait with Leonardo da Vinci wearing that dress? Well, she had a point. You know, it was illogical for Francesco del Giocondo, a wealthy silk merchant who makes his living selling beautiful silks. Why would he permit his wife to be wearing a frumpy house dress? Well, that didn't make any sense. So if the woman in the portrait is not Lisa del Giocondo, and clearly it's not a self-portrait, well then, who is she? Well, I looked into his private life, and we know very little. He was born out of wedlock. He never married. He never had children. He had two assistants. Both the experts say that they had homosexual relations. But however, after Leonardo died, both assistants got married and had children. Then in the early 1900s, two famous psychologists weighed in on his love life, Freud and Raymond Stills. Dr. Freud had read an entry in Leonardo's notebook about a dream sequence, and based on that, he diagnosed that he was homosexual, but he didn't act on his desires. Dr. Stills contended that Freud deserved blame and broad misconceptions about Leonardo and aimed to set the record straight. So after 20 years of research, in his book, his findings were that Leonardo was a well-balanced male with a strong heterosexual drive. Well, there you have it. You have two experts have defined him by his gender, and one said he was straight, and one said he was gay. Well, it didn't answer my question, and my question was, what did Leonardo have to say about love? So far, what I've pieced together is a man operating from his heart and not his head when creating the Mona Lisa. And I don't believe he painted for one second the Mona Lisa to show what a masterful painter he was. In fact, I think he was a bored painter, and I'll talk about that later. So I find no logics involved in his decision-making to paint the Mona Lisa. He's unemployed, living off his savings, freelancing it. No one knows who she is. He moves five times, at least five times, always with the Mona Lisa in tow, Florence, Milan, back to Florence, down to Rome, and to France. And it's the first time in 10 years that he picks up a paintbrush. What is it about this woman that inspires him to start painting again? And then he never gives it up. And no one claims the painting after Leonardo's death, do they? So if he's not painting it for money, and he's not painting it for fame, well then, he must be painting it for love. So I embark on a research, and realistically, I know I'm not going to find the lost love letter. But at best, I plan to look way out of the box to see if I could find a key to unlock his heart. And hopefully, I'm going to find the answer to why Mona Lisa was important to Leonardo da Vinci. Well, primarily, we think of Leonardo as a painter. But in reality, Leonardo only painted 13 pieces. Now, that's not a big, big body of work. When we're talking about Michelangelo, hundreds. When we're talking about Raphael, hundreds. 13, that's not a lot of paintings in a lifetime. So what is Leonardo doing with his time? Well, he's writing. He writes some 7,000 pages that makes up about 24 books. And he's really a jack of all trades. His writings reflect this. He's covered a range of subjects: art, military science, inventions, architecture, math, just a broad brush to name a few. And these original codexes are owned by various institutions around the world, and the only one in private collection is the one that Bill Gates owns, which he paid $1 million a page, and I think it was a total of 27 pages, so roughly around $27 million. Now, Leonardo has a very mysterious, illegible way of writing. He writes left to right, and then you've got to hold it in the mirror to read it. If only I could get access to the notebooks, you know, I could see myself finding out what he had to say about love, but he's written over every other kind of subject. I'm expecting an artist to say something about love. But again, I have a problem, a logistical problem. See, there are a lot of notebooks, the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci. You could find them in bookstores. You could find them in libraries. But this is the problem. The author compile snippets of what they think is important on the subject. For example, if it's architecture, that author will go through all 7,000 pages, pick out what he thinks is important, and then put it in a nice chapter called architecture. Well, for my purposes, that wasn't going to work out. I needed the notebooks, and I needed them in the original form to make my own observations and findings. Well, this is a typical Leonardo page. He has 1 to 15 different subjects on one page, and you could see why the author, you know, of these unabridged books are trying to save you the grief. But today we call this radiant thinking, when someone has a lot of different subject matters on one page. Well, besides needing the notebooks unabridged, I needed an English translation, and that was really near impossible. But luckily, I had befriended a translator in Milan, Italy, who had spent the last 25 years translating Leonardo's notebooks. And so I called him my Leonardo cookie jar. I would email him, I want Atlantis, page 229, and then in the next morning in my inbox, there it was. But in looking through his notebooks, I found very little personal. What I did find is he does 17 entries of the verb to love in Latin, and always upside down. So he would say, I love, you love, you are loving, I have love, you may have love, you would have been loving. In every tense, present, past, future, conditional present, perfect, indicative, you name it. And always upside down. I was really getting nowhere. But finally, I made a breakthrough. And what I notice is on his 13 masterpieces, 5 which are women portraits, he always leaves an interlocking knot. Well, originally I thought perhaps that was his signature, was this interlocking knot, because back in the 1500s, they didn't sign their paintings. But then I thought possibly it was a play on words, because his last name means Vinci, which is to win, but in Latin it means to bond, like sweet bonds. I thought, well, possibly that's it. You probably didn't notice that on the Last Supper, on the lower right-hand tablecloth, that's where he has the knot for the Last Supper. But perhaps I was looking in the wrong direction. Maybe he's not communicating love and emotions in words. Well, maybe it's in knots. So I re-look at the 7,000 pages, this time only looking for knots. So I went back through, and I started to catalog all the Da Vinci knots. I lifted every knot doodle off the page, and I dated it. And then I would notate what other subject was around the knot, and there are hundreds and hundreds to examine. Now, knots aren't new. Every culture, every century has used interlocking knots. They say we are human because of knots. And these knots all have names, you know, like no beginning, regeneration, eternity. They're called eternity knots, endless knots, tie knots. So there's nothing really new. But what I would do is I would start cross-referencing the knots in the notebook to see what he's doing in his life. Well, he's living in Milan. He's with the court of Milan. And this is a portrait that Leonardo does of Cecilia. Cecilia is the mistress of the Duke of Milan. And Leonardo lavishes her in knots. I mean, there's four different knot systems. I always find that he'll put the knot on the woman's sleeve. That's kind of his MO of where you're going to find it. And I think that maybe he had a little bit of interest in her, because I find right at the same time an entry in his notebook, you know, uplifting, where he says, "Love will win." And I wondered if he got emotionally drained doing this, because he doesn't do another portrait for 10 years till he starts the Mona Lisa. Now, Leonardo continues to communicate with Cecilia even after the fall of Milan. And I did find a personal letter he starts in his notebook. It begins with, "Magnificent Donna Cecilia, my beloved goddess, having read your most sweet..." I thought, well, that's personal. So possibly the letter is saying that he's trying to persuade her to come to Rome. But you also see a lot of subconscious doodles in these two later sketches of Cecilia. You know, a row of pyramids representing masculine and feminine, a flower of life, even a little phallic symbol drawn over her head, and lots of knots. Could this have been the Mona Lisa? I don't know, but I'm just keeping it in mind. Now, during this period, between 1490 and 1500, the last 10 years that Leonardo is in Milan, he goes through a major knot fetish. And this a particular fresco that he does in the Ducale Palace, the palazzo there in Milan, it's a large, large salon, and it's a fresco that starts off with seven tree trunks. And these tree trunks... all the branches interlock and converge at the ceiling. And it's amazing. I mean, if they would restore this, this would be as popular as seeing the Last Supper. It's really, truly a magnificent piece that he did. He's also doing more knots during this period. It's unclear. We call these mandalas. These are his knot mandalas. And it represents the Accademia Leonardo da Vinci. It's speculated that it has something to do with an intellectual circle at the court of Milan, but we really don't know. There's been a new dissertation that just came out. Prior to that, we thought it had something to do with his studio, but we're thinking it was an intellectual group of the court people, architecture, mathematicians that all got together. But this is always sort of been a mystery for me. In those six mandalas I just showed you, the seventh one always ends with this engraving of this woman with a knot on her shoulder. And it's still a mystery who she is and how she relates to the knots. So as I'm cataloging the knots that I find in his notebook around the same time, what emerges is something really unexpected. This is his turning point in knots. It really separates him from all other artists. So what happens with his knots at this point, rather than being loopy and decorative and teardrops and eternity knots, they become geometrical, mathematical. And then he reveals what he's really, really passionate about. He's no longer the third person observer of life, but he's actually engaged, and that's in geometry. He has a serious interest in geometry from his very beginnings to his last days in France. And if he were here today, I know we are in awe by Leonardo for the, you know, flying machine, the water shoes, the bicycle. But if he were here today, what he would say he was in awe of was geometry. And his notebooks contain more material on geometry than any other subject. Now, Leonardo's math education blossoms through his best friend, this mathematician, Fray Luca Pacioli, who authored The Divine Proportion with Leonardo illustrating the book. And he's also was the father of accounting. But because Leonardo was born out of wedlock, he's not eligible to receive any formal schooling, which is known as the seven letters. So he's never going to be a mathematician, but this does not stop his passion for geometry. And then once you get into his notebooks, it really becomes obvious. He has a deep fascination for the octagonal shape. And his notebooks are filled. Now, probably what piques his interest about the octagon is octagons are not found really in nature. It's a man-made construction. So, but surely he's aware of the symbolism and the spiritual implications of an octagon, this eight-sided square circle that makes the octagon. And through the ages, you know, it's had its sacred meaning. Regeneration, totality, infinity, rebirth, and transition. And then here we are. This is Leonardo. This is his burning goal. He devotes a lifetime to what's really important to him, more than anything else. It's what has eluded geometers through the ages, their attempts to reconcile the two orders of geometry, the squaring of the circle, or in Italian, it'd be the quadratura del cerco. The problem is that to solve it with absolute precision, a circle is measured by pi, 3.14, and squares are expressed by infinite whole numbers. So why is it so important to him to square the circle? Where is this going to lead? And I just don't know. I just keep asking myself and keep going. But then Leonardo's knot is about ready to unravel. I'm in Seoul, Korea, at a Da Vinci exhibition. I've seen this portrait for more days, years, and months that I really want to disclose. I can see every pixel at a really high, high resolution. I mean, I know the general public can't get close and personal. Copies and books are lousy, but in my defense, the only thing I could say was, if you've ever seen the movie What the Bleep, the expert tells a story about when the Indians see Columbus's sail ships coming over the horizon, and they can't see it because they have never seen a sail ship before. Well, that's what happened to me. What I saw on the bodice of her dress, I just had never seen before, and I couldn't see it, and I didn't recognize it. See, what I saw was what I saw in all the ceremonial costumes of that area. I saw round linked chains. I saw Turk's knots or four-leaf clovers. And I saw eternity knots. That's what I saw. But what merged was an embroidery painted on Mona Lisa's dress that was something unexpected, unexplainable, and extraordinary. It wasn't decorative at all. It was geometrical. It was mathematical. And nothing I had ever seen anywhere. So I remembered my conversation with Jane Bridgman about the frumpy house dress. And I thought I'd better focus in on what she's wearing in the portrait with a new set of eyes. So in Renaissance fashion, what was fashionable was the layered look. So she is wearing three garments. She has... And the other illustration to the right is a better, you could see it better. She's wearing a slip, which is called the camicia. Then over that is a house dress, or known as a gamora. And then over that is called the sciopa, or the cape. So you've got the slip, you've got the house dress, and you've got the cape. So I had talked to Carol Frick. She wrote a book called Dressing Renaissance Florence, and I had her opinion on the house dress and this embroidery. And this is what she writes back to me. An embroidered gamora would be very rare in the 15th century. Interesting. And the cape? Well, she's wearing a wool dress. So Leonardo has her in a cape made of translucent veil, but it should be out of velvet or brocade. And the cape is what should have been embroidered. So just to double check my work, the paintings of typical house dresses of the day, I relook at them. No embroidery found. Now remember, Mona Lisa is not going to go down to her local Macy's and pick up a little frock for her portrait with Leonardo da Vinci. We're in Florence, and the fashion guilds are there. So there's the shoe guild, the sock guild. You're going to even have your underwear made by a guild. Everything has been custom made. And here is Mona Lisa's pattern in a graphics. The pattern's composed of four rows. The first is a rope. The second is a geometrical pattern of 36 octagon chains linked together, followed by another rope, and then a pattern of six crosses that appear to be part of the octagon link. This pattern would have had to been made after the dress was completed by the Embroidery Guild. And I don't believe this design was done by any local town embroiderer. This is the work of a genius with years of thought and planning to execute. So once I made this discovery, I'm left with the question, if Leonardo made up this pattern, why and what does it mean? And will this pattern lead me to their relationship? Frumpy house dress, elaborate geometrical pattern, don't belong together. Now, experts have been baffled that there's no preliminary drawings in any of his notebooks. But now that I know what to look for, it's there. The chain link octagons, it's there. Preliminary drawings of the cruciform. What's interesting is he starts this pattern 10 years before he even starts the Mona Lisa. Does he already know her, this woman, in the painting? And this preliminary drawing I really love. This was done right when he's starting the Mona Lisa. As I had told you before, I would always cross-reference what else was happening on a page. If there were knots, not always, but more likely than not, he has some water system happening. And here this is rushing water going in. But when I blow it up really large, what does it look like? It looks to me like a gown. And what does she have under her armpit? But the beginning of the cruciform. So I started to consult with experts. And I consulted with this Da Vinci scholar. His name is Jacques Franck from Paris. Now, he was a child prodigy artist. But he thwarted his career at the age of 10 when he found Leonardo da Vinci. And what he wanted to decode was how Leonardo did the flesh on her skin. Known as the sfumato technique, and we've never been able to figure out how that's been done. And what he just finally decoded it, and every quarter millimeter of flesh, for him to reproduce it exactly the way Leonardo did, it takes 10 layers of paint and over 10 hours. So I had gone there primarily to find out about the embroider from an artist's point of view. And he told me that these threads were made up of two colors, ochre, yellow, and crimson red. And he felt it took Leonardo 1 year to do this interlocking knot. One inch by 4 1/4 inch. That's a very little space to be taking 1 year of your life to do. It must have been very, very important to him. And from there, I started consulting people in the math world. One of the first was Keith Critchlow. He's an author of numerous books on sacred geometry. What's sacred geometry? It's the belief that God created the universe according to a geometric plan. And in his analyzation of the cruciform, the whole pattern, he made some interesting observations. He said, first of all, it was a celebration, an essay of the octagon and its symbolic meaning. And then in regards to the cruciform, the six on the last bottom row, he said that the overflow of the lines, well, what does it make? It makes also octagons. And then he found a hidden significance. You'll see underneath, between every cross, there it goes two, two, and then in the very center, there's three. And so he says it's the central anomaly, three drops instead of the otherwise consistent two drops. Three meant Trinity, two, duality, and it was composed of the same single thread, representing sameness and otherness. And this same observation are made by the next consultants I interviewed. I had it checked out by Kenneth Millett. He's a professor at mathematics at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and he specializes in knot theory. Now, the easiest way I could explain to you what knot theory, for my purposes, is we do knot theory every day. When you tie your shoes, your tennis shoes, you're holding one lace in each hand. It crosses over, under, and over. And in math, that would be called a trifoil. So they look at the crossings, how it goes under, how it goes over, under, over. And then they start counting every line, 1, 2, 3, 4. So that particular cruciform makes up 20 lines. Now, of course, knot theory was not happening in the 15th century. I mean, that was not Leonardo's world. And it's interesting, since I've talked and been working with Professor Millett, he's doing a dissertation on the Da Vinci six mandalas that I had shown you before, since my introduction to him with the Da Vinci knot. So I'm looking forward to his findings. But Leonardo completely had to be aware that the thread crossings and the sequences that he's doing, which are under, over, over, under, under, under. I mean, he's got to be completely conscious of what he's doing. And this is the pattern of that cruciform. And I'm going to show you now this pattern would do. If I was standing on one end of this pattern and you were standing at the other, this is what would happen to this pattern. So basically, it's a knot that's not a knot. It cancels each other out. And today this is called the Reidmeister knot. What kind of symbolism is Leonardo conveying here? Love can only be experienced in the moment and then it's gone. I don't know, but he definitely had a lot of forethought in what he put together. Now, we know Leonardo had 125 books in his library and Plato was a big part of it. And Plato comes up with the 216, and he writes that it's the number of the bride. It's a number that represents marriage, a product of two female and three male. And there's no coincidences that if you count that bottom row, every line, remember in knot math, 1, 2, 3, 4, well, ironically, it's composed of 216. Interesting. So Leonardo's fatuation with the octagon and squaring the circle. When I discovered this page in his notebook, he makes a very bold declaration stating that he has solved the ancient old problem of squaring the circle. And he dates it, 1504. This is a big deal. I mean, he doesn't date anything. In fact, that's why the experts have all gone nuts over the last 100 years trying to figure out, dating his ink, dating the paper, to try to figure out the timeline of his notebooks. So, and let's just read this, what he writes. The night of St. Andrew, I finally found the quadratura of the circle. And as the light of the candle and the night and the paper on which I wrote were coming to an end, it was completed at the end of the hour. So did solving the square and the circle with the completion of the Mona Lisa knot dovetail? Was there any relationship? Is that why this painting was so important to him? Well, I took the pattern to a geometer, Rachel Fletcher, to analyze to see if perchance this pattern squared the circle. And after doing her calculation, she came back with, yes, I can see it. And I remembered artist Jacques Franck, who said it had taken him a year to complete the pattern on the painting. So he starts the painting in 1503, and the timeline coincides with this notebook entry declaring that he had squared the circle in November 1504. I would have liked to have peeked into that night. Leonardo burning the midnight candle, festivities of St. Andrew. It had to have been pretty powerful. So did this woman inspire him to solve the oldest unsolvable geometrical problem in history? Was their relationship a story of opposing shapes, like a square and a circle? Perhaps they came from different backgrounds. Maybe she was married. But only by the transformation of the octagon was their relationship possible. And the pattern just keeps revealing his deepest inner self. When you extend the lines of the crosses and you extract the cross, what do you find? Voila, the flower of life. And here we find oodles and oodles of Leonardo's drawings on the flower of life. It's a geometric figure composed of multiple evenly spaced overlapping circles, symbols of sacred geometry. It is the pattern of creation and the source of all that exists. Mona Lisa, in a rather frumpy, outdated house dress, Leonardo gives us no clues of her life status, fame, wealth, or title, not even a ring or a necklace to distract us, only an interlocking knot painted on the bodice of her dress, front and center, for all the world to see for the last 500 years. Leonardo's knot that unknots, it's there and not there. The Greeks believed that all beauty is found in mathematics, and that was Leonardo's reality. And as he said, let no man read me that it's not a mathematician. So who is she? We are never to know. It's a secret between Leonardo and his beloved. Kind of romantic, don't you think? Leonardo was the patron and the painter, and the painting belonged to him and him alone. And what did the knot pattern say to her? Well, it was a geometry of love, a message that every human being hopes to hear from another human being. You made me whole and complete. A declaration that opposites can transform. Squaring the circle makes way for possibility to be a marriage between heaven and earth. Leonardo's interlocking knot on his Mona Lisa. No other artist has successfully copied it. So Mona Lisa was his inspiration and his love. May we all be so lucky to find our octagon. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our video online audiences that they're listening to Carolyn Cocciardi speaking about Da Vinci's knots at the Commonwealth Club, and it's time for questions and answers.
It's not a question. Would you go back in the slides and show the virtual slide so we can look at that in blue, just because okay. It's so unusual while you're talking?
Yeah. Which one here?
Oh, the unraveling knot.
The unraveling knot you want to see in 3D space? Oh, the blue one. Okay. Yeah. I didn't get a chance to talk about that one. Yeah, this. This is the virtual restoration of the Mona Lisa. So if we could have seen it the day Leonardo died, this is what it looked like. So the background was done with lapis lazuli, which is more expensive than gold. Yeah, absolutely.
So I have a question. You mentioned that she doesn't have a ring on it. She's supposed to, of course, be married to Giacomo. Do we have any pictures of his mother?
No.
Who did not have a ring?
You mean Leonardo's mother?
Yeah.
Well, it's, dubious. What was interesting is since he was born out of wedlock, normally you would think that the child would have gone with the mom, which we think her name was Caterina. Mm-hmm. But instead he lived with his dad. So she might have been a barmaid. We don't know anything really about her. There's one entry that maybe in Milan she goes to live with him, and he writes a whole list of the expenses of a woman's funeral. And so we think it might have been her, but we have no drawings. We're never to know.
Could you please repeat the name of the work that you mentioned really early on about the tree trunks, which were coming up and then interlocking on the ceiling. I didn't catch the name of that.
It's called Sala di Asse.
Sala di Asse.
Yeah, Asse. And it's really the botched up restoration of it in the 1900s. And, I really, really wish they would redo it. It was a phenomenon. At least the sketches and the paintings I've seen of it. It's really exceptional.
Does it exist?
You can go to
somewhere?
Yeah, you go to the in Milan to the palace, and you can go into that room, but you know there's not much left, and it's you just kind of have to imagine.
Thank you.
What led you to once you found these knots and the unraveling of the knot and the octagon imagery? How did you connect it to the love?
The significance of the, just from what the experts said, you know, it was always the same reoccurring theme, three male, two female, the sacred geometry of what squaring the circle represents. You know, a circle and a square can't make it together, but it's the transformation of an octagon. So all that kind of symbolism played into it for me.
It adds up to the number, the Pythagorean number for marriage.
Right.
The squaring of the circle is also seen in the Vitruvian Man.
Exactly.
Is that related to this in some way?
Well, he started doing that. That's a little bit before when he's still in Milan. And, yeah, he's starting that process of squaring the circle even there. But when he makes this declaration, it's a couple years later.
Go back. What drew you into this part? A lot of people are studying the man and his works, and they have been, and they continue. What drew you into this particular, the knot?
I wanted to find, I just thought that there had to be more of a backstory to Mona Lisa. And if it wasn't for money and if it wasn't for fame, then why did he do the painting? It had to have some great, great significance for him. And so I knew if I followed a trail of love, I'd find something. And I did.
So the frumpy house dress that you
yes.
keep mentioning. It's a pretty nice looking dress. That's why I wonder. It just the fashion expert from England just said that this is only the kind of dress that would just be worn around the house while the work was being done. Or?
Right. So you would never go out in public in that dress. You'd always wear your cape over it if you're going to church or to the market. So you only wear that dress at home. Mm-hmm. And so having it embroidered was completely out of context for what was happening in fashion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you would need to have an embroiderer do that. And, you know, it just wasn't happening where an embroiderer would be embroidering a house dress.
Would it be difficult for you to show again, the series of slides that show the unraveling of the geometry into the line.
Yeah, I could do that. You know, while we're here, though, one thing I want to mention, if Leonardo had an ego when he was painting this, it's really about the veil, the cape on the veil. And then you can't really see it well, but over this interlocking knot stitched on the top row is actually a just sheer veil, transparent, that's cloaking it just slightly. And it's really where he, you know, his mastery of knowing what the heck he's doing as a painter shows through in the veiling.
Well, you also mentioned that, you know, for each square millimeter, he spent 10 layers of paint. And
yeah. And by the way, Jacques Franck thinks he can reduplicate it. It would take him 2 years. And none of the other copies have copied this.
Next question.
There she is.
Are there other Renaissance painters that incorporate knots in paintings that are this period? You showed us some stuff that's a little bit earlier.
Let's see, Raphael on the colonial piece has some knots on the altar. But, you know, in clothing, we see these decorative knots everywhere. Before Leonardo, after Leonardo. But what makes Leonardo different is that he's takes it from the decorative knot to the mathematical knot. Yes.
Is there any other place in the picture where he uses sacred geometry that you can tell?
In the Mona Lisa, I only studied the knots. I mean, probably there are, but, you know, most everything I focused on was the knot pattern.
Well, he used, you mentioned mentioned Vitruvian Man before. He used the proportions that come from Pythagorean mathematical theory in that as well. So those were, and for those who aren't aware of that, this was a long tradition. Pythagoras came up with this idea that everything is made of number. He was so excited by the mathematical analysis that he noticed. One of those was that an octave in music is the string is exactly twice as long. That he came to the conclusion everything was made of number. Now, that's an exaggeration when you get excited about something, of course. But the influence of that idea on Western civilization is tremendous because, first of all, it changed Western music because of that. But in addition to that, all of the Greek temples and the theaters that come from that all use different mathematical proportions that are based on the psychological value of each of those numbers, because the Pythagoreans didn't just call them numbers, you know, and say that they were you know, divine or anything. Each one, as you mentioned, five was the number for marriage, and every number had a meaning, and therefore, if you had 3 and 8, it was, you know, as the relationship between different parts of your theater, it meant something. But if it was 5 and 3, it was another thing. So that's why the Parthenon has kept everyone fascinated, because it's supposed to look straight when you look at it, but it is not built straight so that it will look straight when you look at it from a distance. And that kind of mathematics had never been done before, and it was about 100 years after Pythagoras that they did that.
So. Now, that's probably why he chose the poplar board, because he could get the height and the width that he wanted, which is
right.
Probably has to do with
exactly the ratio. They're different ratios.
Geos. Yeah.
So all those different ratios are big, and of course, a lot of it has to do with the 3-4-5 triangle of the Pythagorean theorem. For those of you who know about that, I mean, that's 3, 3, and 4, and 5, and the 3 and 4 on each side, then it would make an exact length of 5 on the diagonal. So they use that quite often in their descriptions. So we have time for one more question. Who would like to ask the last question?
Can you show the unraveling knot backwards? So that
no.
There's one thing she can't do. And we found it, and that may be a great way to end the lecture.
Yeah.
So thank you very much,
thank
Alan.
You. It's really a delight. Thanks.
So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.